This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Christina Torres of Ciclista Zine, and you're listening to the Wheel Suckers podcast.
Hi, I'm your Captain Alex, and I was raised on a tandem, and I'm an ex-cycling industry goof, and I'm with my stoker.
Jenny Stoken here. I am the director of the London Bike Kitchen. I am the author of How to Build a Bike and also chair of the Women of Color Cycling Collective. Today we're talking with Christina Torres about Ciclista Zine, performative activism, and Sherlock the Dog. Please, special guest, introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Christina Torres. I go by she, her, Aya. I am Kawaisu, Paiute, Niue, and Chicana Tijon Reservation in California, speaking to you in the unceded ancestral lands of the Munsee, Lenape, Wappinger peoples in so-called New York. I am the Zinester of Ciclista Zine, and we are the radical feminist response to the cycling industry.
Love it.
Yes.
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 Welcome to the show.
So excited to have you.
Likewise. Likewise. I just wanted to state I've been a fan for a really long time. So I'm happy to be sharing space with you guys.
Oh my God, we're sharing a space.
I know.
We'll kick off, I think, with, can you share your cycling story with us? It's always nice to hear an origin story, but how you got into riding and maybe a bit about where you like to cycle?
Yeah, I like to share like my bike story, like how I first learned to ride a bike. But I learned how to ride a bike from my older sisters. We would help each other learn how to ride two wheels instead of training wheels. And I was one of those kids like who wanted to master something alone. So I would wait for them to go to school, like practice pedaling without training wheels, and kind of just picked it up. And since bikes kind of featured in my life as fun ways to hang out with friends or with cousins and just riding around the neighborhood, school, or going to the library. But I would say like my passion and advocacy for bikes as active transit was accidental. And that started when I moved to San Francisco. Mm. Like I took my teenage Huffy mountain bike with me when I moved there so that I could commute to like my coffee shop job at 4 a.m.
Is this That's in the city of San Francisco?
The city in San Francisco,
oh, no.
Yeah. And like there were trains. And, you know, trains did not run at 4 a.m.
No.
So I had to, like, ride my bike there from the Mission to like, the financial district. But then I grew out of it. And
were there
I
hills?
No, it was actually pretty flat, like, going from Mission to, like, Market Street, like, up 3rd or up 3rd Street. But then I grew out of that bike and I just stopped commuting and then I took public transit. But when the stock market crashed in 2009, that's when I started bike commuting again as an affordable alternative mode, largely because like public spending was cut and train pass costs like hiked and I needed an affordable option to get to school and work. And my boyfriend then, you know, had been deeply involved, like, in the bike scene. And I've been talking to him about, you know, riding a bike for commuting. And he surprised me, like, with my first commuter bike, which then was a 1986 World Sport Schwinn road bike.
Amazing.
And yeah, and I DIY converted that bike, which I'm doing another right now because that bike was stolen. And I love it and I miss it. And has a special place in my heart. But since I've like been biking and have done everything from like commuting, road biking, mountain biking, bike packing, but not like in a hardcore sense. This is like a recreational life. And I've cycled to a lot of places, been to different cities. But I think right now, like mountain biking has really grown on me. And it's hard to point to like one place that I like to go when I just like being on the land, like just being surrounded by trees, plant life, and the dirt. And for me, it's just like the best bike medicine out there.
I love bike medicine.
Bike medicine's a great phrase.
Yes.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you think mountain biking has kind of stolen your heart? is it the bike medicine or
the bike medicine? I think largely, you know, when you're like commuting or when you're road biking, like you have to deal with cars a lot, and like, and when you want peace and quiet, like you have to go outside, like really outside, you know, quieter, the rural side. And I actually live in, you know, rural New York. So I live by a lot of parks, trails. And I think even road biking out here would kind of be challenging because we don't have biking infrastructure. We have rail trails, but those are far to get to, where the mountain bike parks are a lot easier to access. But I think like, I really like being surrounded by nature, and I really like, just being on the land. There's something that is the experience on the brain is very different than being on the road. I just think, you know, there's a lot of research out there to support how being surrounded by greenery, trees, really helps to reduce depression or anxiety. And I think a lot of folks, you know, use the bike as a way to manage that, to manage mental health. I like to use it for both mental health and to connect with the land. I think just you know, from a native cultural sense, just having the ability to be on the land and to be supported and surrounded by plant relatives, animal relatives, you don't ever really feel alone on it. So that's why I like to call it bike medicine, because it, you know, it does a lot for the mind. It does a lot for the body too. I feel like I get like a full body workout.
Mind, body and soul.
I love it.
You're not speeding through it, you know? You're not speeding through it. You're not ignoring
just enjoying
things.
Yourself.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I need more bike medicine. I'm really missing that.
Yeah, I've topped up my dosage. I've got a little mini wheeler I just got fixed, and it's just so much fun to ride. I was riding fixed, like, 6 years riding fixed in London.
Oh, wow.
I just can't do it anymore. Now I just want to scoot. I just want to look. Yeah, I want to look at the birds, look at horses.
Yes.
And chill out, enjoy it. Yeah.
Bike medicine.
Coast. Yeah. So I've got a new prescription and it's working. So important.
It's good medicine for you.
Yeah. I missed it. I really missed it. Yeah. I'm like either going out in the morning before work or going out in my lunch break.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was doing it every day for work. And now, you know.
Yeah. It's a lot to, you know, like you guys know, like city biking is tough. Yeah.
It is. It's not fun. It's it's a rat race.
It is. It is. And I think that's a nice thing about like being out on trails too, is, you know, you're not rushed. you know, you could do a trail multiple times and not have to worry about time. You're not having to worry about other people behind you it's nice to go at a different, it's a different pace for sure. And, you know, you really have to focus on your skills and balance. It's just very different from all other farms I've experienced. But yeah, I don't know what it is. It just feels, it feels wild sometimes. it's like, wow, I could do that stuff. Yeah. I never knew I could do that. But it does give you a different sense of appreciation for what your body can do. Like even you can share those skills amongst other cycling disciplines as well. Sometimes like even on my road bike, I'm like trying to jump over stuff and like, this wasn't made for that.
Or buddy hop, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I love that, the reframing of like, this is what a bike can do. It's not just like a commuting thing, like based on work and capitalism and get you there as fast as possible. It's not about speed. It's about like relaxing and being human and just existing. And yeah. I love that. Just
connecting with the land is so different, right? So like, I think when you're in the city, you kind of miss out on connecting with your community.
Yeah.
The people around you, the businesses around you.
Especially since the pandemic.
It's so different. Exactly. And that's actually when I took up mountain biking, was during the pandemic. Mm. I never really saw myself as, you know, as a mountain biker, but I don't even know what that meant, you know? I didn't know what that meant. I just, because I never was part of that culture, but yeah. It didn't matter. It didn't matter to me in the end, and it still doesn't. I just think it's just so good to be out there, be connected in a different way.
I think that's a really good way of presenting it to people who maybe have no interest in cycling, because the image with cycling is always roadie, you know, go as fast as possible. And it's like, there's another way. Like, you don't have to go down that path. Like, you can, you know, commune with nature. And I don't know, the WCCC, we're going on our first bike packing trip end of July. Ooh. And for most of the women, it's their first time camping. This is the kind of thing where it really introducing to people like new ideas and new ways of riding, and
it's so nice to do it together, because it's so daunting to do it on your own. I've done it, and it's, you've got to be in the right mindset, I think, to be prepared to deal with stuff.
Yeah,
being with other people, that's just so nice. I think that's a really nice way to do it.
But I think labels really do more harm than good.
Agreed. Like you said,
what is a mountain biker? It's just, you're just riding on dirt.
Yeah. And dirt is good for you.
Yes.
It's good to be on dirt. It's good. It's good. I'm excited for you guys to go bikepacking and to hear about their experiences, because that's another way to connect to the land as well. And also, you know, it's good medicine just to be in that community as well.
Absolutely.
And to be sharing those experiences together. It's so exciting.
Yeah. It's really sweet.
Yeah. It's going to be really cute.
It'll be so cute. Everyone's going to like, do you guys remember your first bike packing trips?
Yeah.
Oh God. Just the struggle of, I had a leaking tent the first time.
Oh no.
That wasn't fun.
I still remember to this day being so cold. I don't ever remember being. Yeah. I had sleeping bag, all my clothes on, socks, hat, gloves, and I was freezing.
Yeah.
Yep.
So cold. And then the sun comes up and then the tent gets boiling. Yeah. And it was just so frustrating that I spent the whole night not sleeping because I was cold. And then I spent the morning sweating and being too hot. Yeah. I don't think, you know, when you just... some emotions never like leave you. Like I will just always remember feeling really, really cold.
That's one. I think that's one that sticks with a lot of people. Like, mm-hmm. Like honestly, even I have that memory in the forefront of my mind. I think my first bikepacking trip was in Vermont, like during I think fall, and it's beautiful out there in the fall. And I just remember like how cold it was, but it was like in your bones cold. And it's like no matter how many fires you had, how much like warm tea you had or coffee, like you just couldn't get that cold out of your bones. Yeah, it's difficult, but it's, and that's, you know, memories.
Memories, yeah memories. But type you two also fun. Learn.
Yay!
You also learned like next time. I've gotten this super down sleeping bag because I sleep really cold. And yeah. Anyways, we've gone a bit off piste.
Do you want to read the next? Yeah, do you want to read the next question, Jenny?
Well, it's hard because a lot of the things we've touched on, I'm like, oh, we could go down the path of, you know, because so recently you made a little mini zine, Christina, about, I think, land recognition, about. And bikepacking?
Yeah, recreating outside, ride outside responsibly is the mini zine.
Yeah. And so tying that in with the bigger zine, like, can you tell us how Ciclista came about?
Well, and for those who don't know what it is, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, there might be some of
what
you.
What is Ciclista zine?
Yeah, I'm happy to share. Well, how Ciclista zine started... you know, through my cycling journey, and prior to that, I was writing about biking and advocacy on the blog, my blog, A City Girl Rides. That it was there to share, share experiences, tips from the streets, so that access to cycling would be easier. And I think there was a point for me in which I got really tired of reading the same old narratives from the same voices in cycling media. There, you know, we didn't have as much inclusivity. We weren't celebrating BIPOC voices or alternative cycling cultures. And I think there's just a point where, you know, I found myself writing a lot about these issues of gender inequality or lack of diversity in cycling. And just also sharing ways we could do better. But I also knew deep down that no matter how much I talked about this or how much we talked about representation, equity, inclusion, that we needed a platform and space to educate and to tell our stories. Mm-hmm. And that we needed a safe space to do that. So I thought the zine format was a great way to do that. Where we, you know, we didn't have to filter our words. We didn't have to police what we were going to say, how we presented ourselves. Also, I didn't want us to portray a privileged form of cycling, being white, male, middle class, able-bodied. And I didn't want to create a magazine or space that sold products either. I wanted mm-hmm. these stories to be told. I wanted them to include voices other than my own. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to do a call for submissions and I'm going to focus around this theme. And they started rolling in. I was pretty surprised with the responses that people were giving because I had to start out by doing a lot of education of why there were barriers in cycling, why there was gender inequality within cycling as well. And I think people wanted to understand, but also wanted to talk about their experiences, wanted also to provide alternative ways for people to connect and to create more inclusive spaces. So that's pretty much how the zine started. Yeah. This is
right, the right time. Like, people were hungry for that, I think.
Mm-hmm. They really were. And I think I started it, in 2019 of August. Our first zine came out in the fall of 2019. And, you know, that's just months before the pandemic and the, you know, George Floyd protests. And I think that a lot of people, you know, were really hungry for a space, really, really hungry to share these experiences, which a lot of media really shies away from, mm-hmm. To a fault. And yeah, I think it was time to just be like, you know what? No, this is, you know, this is really important that we have a space that we do tell our stories, that, you know, also we do enough education already to talk about our experiences, but what are some tangible actions people, you know, can do, or, you know, to create their own spaces as well. I think a lot of people wanted something different. And I think a lot of the collaborators that we work with do provide alternative DIY cultures. They provide alternatives. And I think a lot of people are hungry for something, you know, solutions or ways to do that without having some sort of like gatekeeping culture around mm-hmm. cycling. Yeah, it's like trickle down like hierarchies, you know, like even within like local biking spaces too. And I think that having alternatives is a really important way for us to build communities and futures. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just showing people there's another way to exist. Like, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be a hierarchy where people mm-hmm. are constantly guarding what they have. Like, mm-hmm. they don't want to give it away, and instead creating a model where it's like, no, I'm going to lift up other people's voices and give you mm-hmm. opportunities. And it's like, it's so refreshing, especially in like the bike world.
Yeah. Because I still think about like the rules book, you know, and how yeah. just disgusting and toxic it is.
I have that book, by the way.
Yeah, I also have it, and I read it, and it just makes my blood boil. And
throw it out the window.
I knew a cyclist back in the day who wanted to live by these rules and was, you know, had anxiety and stress by not like fulfilling all of these rules. And that's exactly how it shouldn't be. Like, we should all be able to come at cycling with our own kind of, you know, take on it and meet other people, and it not be, oh, you're doing this and oh, you're doing that and you can't do this and that. Like, it's strange, but I think you have to have those things for it to change.
Yeah.
You know, a book like that has to come out so that people could go, no, actually.
Let's not do
that. Gone too far.
Yeah.
But here's the other thing about books like that, also that mainstream media has like maintained a certain cycling culture that sells really well. Mm-hmm. And they sell to a certain demographic of people. Who can have access to these, you know, to these goods, to being able to cycle without fear of discrimination. So they've benefited from selling this type of yeah. culture.
Yeah.
Right. And those people who are like, oh, I've got to fit in, you know, I've got to be this, you know, look pro. Like, a lot of us, I have even bought into that for a moment, because that was what I was being marketed, right? Mm-hmm. And freaking marketing, you know, like, it works. And I had to cut myself off at one point and just think, like, why aren't we talking about these barriers to cycling? Like, why do we have so many cycling deaths happening? And we did in New York in 2019, and it was so bad. And why are we having so many of these deaths? Like, what is going on? Why are we putting so much energy into maintaining a gatekeeping cycling culture maintained yeah. in like white supremacy and patriarchy?
Yeah.
Why are we maintaining that when we should be using our energy to tackle this, you know, these issues of, you know, street safety, access, you know, access to safe streets, access to bikes, you know, green transportation, active transportation. Why aren't we putting our energy into that when, you know, instead we're like gatekeeping mm-hmm. this really toxic culture where people are policing each other's bikes, what they're wearing, the length of their socks.
It's pathetic. It makes you think of that image of like a dog with a lead, like with the other dogs on a lead. Like, don't miss in that. It's like one dog leading the other. It's like, no.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, so I think, you know, I think that was the point where I was just kind of like, all right, we need to tackle these issues. Like, why aren't we seeing these stories in mainstream media? Why is it that when there is a bike accident that we're highlighting white people when they're not the ones, and you know, who aren't affected by traffic, bike and car traffic incidences? Mm-hmm. It's mostly men of color, immigrant mm-hmm. men. But you know, why are we telling those stories and not telling these other ones? And you know, and we're continuing to promote a certain cyclist through that too, when you know, who often has more privilege and access to to certain bikes, a certain lifestyle. So I thought it was really important to talk about these things. You know, we need to spend more time going through these conversations of, okay, what, you know, how do we make cycling accessible? How do we dismantle these barriers? What is it on a societal level that is, creating these issues? So the zine was just a really good way to share that information, to educate folks, because I think a lot of the time, you know, we pinpoint so much of cyclists' faults to their behaviors, mm-hmm. and rather than look at the societal structures that maintain those hierarchies as well.
Yeah, which then result in those behaviors.
Exactly.
Like how our environments influence our actions.
Yep. Exactly.
And you're on zine number 5 now? 5 is taking submissions?
Yes. We have actually closed the call for submissions. We've got plenty.
Nice.
for number 5. So hopefully that will be out by next month, the end of next month. I've kind of given myself permission to take things slower. With zine making, as well, just because like it's such a process,
yeah.
to go through, and it does pick up a lot of time. But yeah, we gave a lot of folks themes that they could work off of, ideas that they can pitch. Yeah, and we've got some really really good stories and really good forms of like activism that people are sharing in this next issue. So yeah, issue 5 is coming.
Christine, if you don't mind, like, I'd love to know a bit more about yourself and how it informs your work. Like, where are you coming from?
Yeah, so my, you know, my background comes full circle for me and how it informs my work. You know, there's my background growing up Native and Chicana. You know, where storytelling is one way we learn and pass on knowledge. And I was taught that we're all made of stories, that our identities and existence are accumulation of stories that we gathered through our ancestors and personal lifetimes, and that it's a gift to be able to share. And then there's growing up, you know, poor and needing to bike as a form of transportation. And there's Occupy Wall Street during my college years at UC Berkeley that radicalized me. That
nice.
Also,
Berkeley.
Go Bears.
Yeah, go Bears.
And there, you know, that also informed like my research in sustainable urban development. That was also influenced by biking and blogging. And there's years of existence and, you know, and just being a woman in biking. And then there's working also in data analytics, patient advocacy, biotech industry. You know, that for me was like patient data is a lot like storytelling. And it gives us insights into the reality of how things are actually going, you know, how to solve issues and provide solutions that have been there all along. For zines to hold those stories and solutions, and they are tools, you know, for alternatives and inclusive futures that have been imagined and that are being created. So the zine itself is just, you know, it's an accumulation of all those experiences of that background, and also the intersecting identities of myself, but also of others who share their stories. So it was important to use like the frameworks of intersectional feminism to tell our stories in zine format. For those who don't know, intersectional feminism, it was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, that described intersectionality as the acknowledgement that our social identities overlap and intersect and form new, more specific identities with new implications. And the individual identity groups we belong to, like race, class, gender, sexuality, nationality, they don't exist in a vacuum and they cannot be compartmentalized. So intersectionality acknowledges that a person can simultaneously belong to multiple historically marginalized groups. So intersectionality gives us a framework to critique and improve our analysis of oppression that includes our identities. So in circles of cycling, when we talk about creating space that are for Black, Indigenous, and people of color, or women, trans femmes, there often are experiences, even in those spaces, that are exclusionary mm-hmm. towards folks like Black, trans women, or queer women of color. So while we are carving out spaces that are supposedly inclusive, we should also be including and holding hard conversations about addressing racial and patriarchal oppression in those spaces that often are full of more cis gendered people. So that gives us a framework of how to address the zine and how it's influenced a lot of the work I do within the zine.
Nice. Awesome. Let's dive a bit deeper into intersectionality and move into performative activism and allyship and tokenization and crumb culture. All these things.
Can I admit, I haven't heard of crumb culture.
Well,
I'll tell you a bit about it.
Yeah, please. I was like, ooh, haven't heard that one. Whoops.
Oh. I think, like, following on from the Black Lives Matter protests last year, I think, like, a lot of brands especially took these, like, big statements about, oh, this is what we believe in now, and we don't, you know, we're going to support BLM, and then a year on, it's kind of like, hello, anybody here?
Yeah.
And I think it's linked to this stuff, but I'd love to hear your take on this, Christina.
Yeah, I think we're a year out from seeing a lot of performative activism in allyship. And we saw those forms from Black Squares. We're seeing it in rainbow washing.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing it in social media posts about initiatives and promises that industry, athletes, advocates would do better to listen, learn, and do their part in last year's racial uprising. And now that we're a year out, now that Black Lives Matter isn't trending anymore, and we're all going back to brunch, a lot of those initiatives, like, have been forgotten. There was, like, millions of dollars that were promised to be invested, were those have not been material yet. And a lot of those initiatives have been forgotten. And you know, there's like loads of data out there to support that people are not listening anymore. They're not doing the work anymore. And instead, we are doing things like June 13th without reparations.
Yeah.
Also, the industry has been very silent about the anti-trans bills that are going on. And also, we haven't defunded, disarmed the police.
Yeah.
Like Black Lives Matter was demanding. And this is a touchy subject for a lot of people. So I need people to overcome their defensive reactions when I say that all these displays of allyship have their place, but are ultimately performative when they don't result in action, when they don't exist without reparations and ongoing support for the communities people are claiming to ally with. And of course, issues and voices should be heard, and maybe some small version of justice, you know, can be served. But what I want people to get from this is be careful to not be lulled into believing that waving or wearing a flag is a kind of allyship that is enough to dismantle the conditions that made it possible for a young Black girl to be shot 4 times and for trans rights to be stripped. And we can't let that kind of performative allyship begin and end with Black squares, pride shirts, and hashtags. So the other thing about allyship is that allyship has to be earned. So when allyship does more for ourselves than for the people it professes to help, we have a problem. And I get that it could be a really hard pill to swallow, but the best medicines are bitter. And we are all learning, understanding, and healing, and that the markers of our humanity aren't in how perfect we are, but allyship is how far we are willing to go as down for the cause co-conspirators. And the other thing that we've seen with performative allyship is how the industry has profited off of representation without true diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Yep.
Ultimately, they are tokenizing people for diversity points in their campaigns. And we've seen this for a long time with how diversity in cycling is mostly a white woman on a bike as a marker for diversity. And that still happens today. Yep. And I like to call this chocolate chip representation.
Go on.
Where most of the diversity is cis white women, and there are a few Black and brown people mixed in media, in their corporate structure, etc. So when brands, you know, do that, people can see through it. And then you have a few folks who are like, yay, great, I can see myself. But what about going beyond being tokenized for our diversity? And when we talk about crumb culture, it's when we just accept that. It's like just accepting
the cookie crumbs.
The cookie crumbs. Exactly.
See.
We're accepting just the cookie crumbs. It's like, hey, we're going to do the least. We're just going to give out free stuff. We're going to have a few brown faces here and there. And that's it. And they'll make these gestures, but that's as far as it goes. So then I have questions like, how are we pushing these brands to make reparations and come correct? Because they benefit from a system that is exclusionary, right?
Yeah.
So reparations has to be part of that work. And what is the end goal for being represented in these corporate spaces without bullying our communities with us? And I personally struggle with this Because while I love to see my friends in major media outlets, I love hearing their stories. But for myself personally, I really struggle with being perceived through the colonial gaze. Mm. And doing the same things that everyone else is doing on stolen lands to make a profit for sponsored ads. And to me, that means they are making a profit off of Indigenous removal, off of our erasure, off of lands my relatives and other Indigenous people have been forced off of. And I have these conversations with like other Indigenous outdoor advocates. And oftentimes, like, I will talk about this in campaigns and with my communities that, you know, we should be creating forest-biased spaces, that we should be supporting Black, Indigenous, and people of color companies, and that we should be working with brands, that if we do choose to work with brands, that we should be creating long-term reciprocal relationships through community investments by helping us serve our communities. So these conversations are, you know, I'm having outside of the zine as well. I'm having conversations with different media outlets about how to better represent Indigenous land, about how to better represent Indigenous voices also, without exploiting Indigenous pain, without exploiting Indigenous erasure. Mm-hmm. And these aren't fun conversations to have, but they are absolutely necessary for us to have.
Do you find that people are listening?
It really depends. I focus a lot of my energy on conversations that have to deal with the land and Indigenous erasure. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes I've experienced conversations where people want me to tell them how to do things. Like, they want me to give them a plan.
Like, they don't want to do the work.
It's either they want to do their work or they just want to get on with it.
Hmm.
Right? So, like, okay, we have this problem. All right. Tell me what to do so that I can get on with it.
Hmm.
Where the outcomes...
Yeah, it's not that...
It's not that simple. And a one and done does not make anyone an ally.
And it also doesn't change anything.
It doesn't change anything. Allyship is long term. Allyship is long term. It's doing the work daily. Mm-hmm. It's constantly having to address how our privileges, you know, take up space, how it takes opportunities away from folks, or how it silences others.
Mm-hmm.
How that privilege and power dynamic is shared. Yeah, so I think allyship is long term. It's also being able to give up your privilege and to pass on opportunities, to pass the mic to others mm-hmm. who should be taking center stage on an issue. Yeah, so there's a lot to be learned through these lessons.
I'm curious, you use the term the colonial gaze, and I have to admit, I've not heard that before, and I want to know more. Can you explain that?
Yeah, the colonial gaze is often like, so this is a term that we use a lot in the Native community. It is when folks of color tend to tell stories for the consumption of a certain demographic that is palatable. Does that make sense?
Like, it's so, for white people.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Where we deny certain, we're denying certain truths, we're denying certain realities to be shared because we don't want to offend white folks.
Okay, I get it. Yeah.
Or it could be that, yeah. Or we are exploiting our cultures for consumption.
Making your culture more white in a, like, acceptable in a way?
Yes.
Kind of turning yourself into marketing and branding.
Exactly.
Right?
So you're assimilating. Mm. You're like assimilating you're assimilating your culture. You're making it palatable for others for entertainment. So there's a, you know, like, especially in the Native community, there's a lot of pushback about us sharing our culture online, about us sharing, you know, traditions, stories, because, you know, a lot of that information can get appropriated and sold. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of conversation about, you know, what things we should share, what things we shouldn't be sharing, because a lot of these things are sacred too. They're not for consumption. So when I talk about the colonial gaze, it's like, okay, am I going to make my story a story about assimilation? Am I going, or like, because assimilation for me in the context of cycling is like going out and doing things and talking about the land the same way everyone else is. It's not acknowledging the lands that I'm on. It's not treating, you know, land as a relative. It's not asking it for consent, etc. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of nuance, like, in the term colonial gaze from that perspective, but it is generally when we are telling our stories for white consumption. Yeah.
No, that's really, really interesting. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I struggle with it a lot, just being very present on social media.
Yeah.
It's an interesting one, but it's a process too. It's a process of having to understand, like, at the end of the day, like, I could choose to tell a certain story, or I can choose to share parts of myself that honor my culture, but also honor myself.
Yeah.
In a way. So, yeah.
And you have the right to do that, and people shouldn't get angry that you don't want to share something.
Yeah, it's...
That's the problem of the culture we're in, though. You know, it's... You're expected to share everything.
Don't.
You're expected to be online. You're expected to...
Give everything away for free.
Parasocial relationships, you know, it's just more rife now with social media more than ever, and it's so hard to fight against it.
It really is. I think that's the point you made there, Alex. I think that when I bring up the colonial gaze, like, that is my way of fighting against it. You know, especially, like, I constantly hear my grandma in my head just being like, don't tell people you're an Indian. Because the issues that she had to grow up with, of the abuses of being Native, you know, the way certain systems would go after Native children. So she was, you know, always like, you know, don't tell people. And I, you know, I live with that a lot.
That's so painful to hear.
Yeah, it's, it is painful, tough. Especially with a lot of the news coming out of Canada and America with the boarding schools. And it's one of those things where it's kind of like, I really have to resist this urge to, like, want to share certain stories that my family would share with me about their experiences, or, you know, things like that. So I have to really honor those spaces, that space for myself, and those stories, that a lot of them are sacred, because our ancestors had to hide them. They had to bury them.
It's the only way it was going to survive.
It's kind of why I struggle with social media. And, you know, I think with the zine, though, the zine allows me to share things in a different way that, it, you know, because zines are just so, they're just radical in nature. That storytelling through zines, I don't have to also worry about that. I don't have to worry about vast consumption, or I don't have to worry about like who my demographic is going to be. I know that, you know, other people are going to understand my story. They're going to understand that narrative as well. But I think for any person looking at for alternative ways to tell their stories, like zines are a really, really good way to do that, because you're not having to police yourself to write under, you know, a certain system, whether it's academic, whether it's journalism,
or making advertisers happy.
Exactly.
Yeah, getting the ads
exactly. Exactly. So I think zine formats are a really good way to tell our stories, without having to worry so much about the colonial gaze.
It's really nice, like, the correlation between, like, the freedom that a bike could give you and the freedom of a zine. I just think that's a really nice correlation.
I like it.
Yes, because they, like, and I always say this to myself, like, zines, bikes are tools for freedom, right? That's how we've known them. Zines are also tools for freedom. So, like, while we know that, like, bikes and zines, like, can't solve everything, we know that they can take us to places that are liberating. We know that they are ways to express ourselves that are liberating as well. So I think there's such a beautiful relationship between liberation and bikes and zines. Yeah, it's, there's so many similarities. Yeah.
Love it.
I'm into it.
All goes hand in hand.
Yeah, for sure.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So this came up for me when a specific company mapping app, no names
shall be said,
came up with a list of like famous bikepacking routes that hadn't been documented yet on their platform. And I did a cursory search through some of them and found that like three off the top of my head were going through conflict zones or occupied land, like Israel and Palestine, one of them, and Tibet, another one. And it was like they had no clue. And I just was thinking, look, we all love cycling and bikepacking and camping, how do we reconcile this with not participating or contributing in colonialism? Was my question, but also just raising the awareness of it is another issue.
Yeah, we've been going through in the States, like we've been going through some of these exercises ourselves of naming roots. And I think, you know, bikepacking, gravel riding, and all cycling in settler or conflict states are taking, you know, they are taking place in occupied lands. First and foremost, we need to recognize that those lands are occupied or they are in conflict zones. In addition, you know, we also see stories of people riding through conflict zones, like borders are in, you know, in war-torn countries as well, where there's often like a lack of acknowledgement of the people of those lands or the realities of what's happening on those lands. And it's just a weird glorification of like rugged individualism and adventure seeking through those places. So to reconcile this, I think we first have to acknowledge our privilege in these spaces, whether that's acknowledging our national, you know, privilege. You know, I think as coming from Western countries, we have a lot of privilege to move through borders. And also, whether we are white or non-white, you know, we do hold certain privileges of being able to move through spaces without having to worry about the safety of our bodies. We need to recognize the history of those lands and be aware of the language that we use about those places, and also abstain from naming places that are, that don't belong to any of us. And what I mean when I'm talking about language is terms like explore, outside is free, wilderness, adventure, public lands, parks, conservation, preservation, discover, any colonial names of those lands are all products of colonization, are all products of conflict zoning and indigenous removal. So I often would tell people, abstain from partaking in rugged individualism in the quest of finding yourself in places that have been stolen and are from, you know, those whose cultures are deeply tied to those lands. I think I've read too many stories in bikepacking where that happens way too often. There's no acknowledgement of the land. There's no acknowledgement of what's going on. There's no acknowledgement of the reality of what is happening to the people. But somehow they can go find themselves in these places. And, you know, that is privilege. That's the privilege of being someone who benefits from colonialism. And we really do need to check ourselves. And I've had plenty of experiences this last year where people would do that. They would go through tribal territories that these areas had asked people to not travel through them because of COVID and how they were, you know, how their communities were being affected by it. And people would do it anyways. You know, had to have conversations for accountability on that. And I think we really have to respect people and their lands. I think like the other thing I see a lot too is when we travel to other countries, how people also act, how they act towards the locals. How, you know, I think I've seen it a lot from like Americans, particularly when they would go to the south of the border specifically. How they would behave or talk to the locals. And a couple of times where I'd have to be like, hey, like, you got to have some respect here. You know, like, this is, our cultures are tied in, you know, in reciprocal respect and relationships. So, you know, let's tone down the Americanism.
It's just that it's the privilege, though. It's the entitlement. And
God,
it really rubs me the wrong way.
I feel like it's just selfishness as well. Like, sometimes just people not having an ability to just think outside themselves and the people around them. But
it's a lot of things.
When you've never had to.
It's a lot of things, but it's like, it's also like an entitlement, right? So an entitlement that, like, I can go to your lands and behave however I want to. I can loot. I can, you know, I can trash. I can bargain. Yeah. I can take. It's like a very colonial mindset. Yeah. And I think Americans, like, still process the outdoors that way. They still talk about land that way. They still talk about travel that way. And I really do think that we need to check ourselves from thinking that we have any sort of ownership to other people's lands or other people's cultures. There's just this entitlement to take. And that's, you know, this is something that I've had to be aware of growing up as a native myself. And it also being ingrained in me growing up, just be aware of how you behave. You know, like, be aware of how you talk about certain things. Be aware of this. Respect. You know, like, I grew up with, like, my parents giving me a lecture in the car before we went to go visit a family's member's house. Like, don't go into their bedrooms. Don't go into their, you know, into the refrigerators. Always ask for something. Be polite. Like, this isn't your house. Respect their things. Don't touch their things. So it's like, I grew up with that, but not everyone grows up with that.
Yeah. No, that's good parenting. I wish I could say that to some people I know now.
Well, I think that, and the zine that you made, I think, about this as well, about recognizing the land that you're on, definitely ties in with this and how people can be more conscious about where they are and respecting everything, the people, the land. And that zine is available, is it on the website? Like, you can cut it out, you print it and you fold it in a fun way. I love the little cutting out bits and it folds into this tiny little booklet.
Oh, great.
So we have a we have e-zine library, so an internet zine library, where folks can download mini zines or booklet zines for free on our website, seclisazine.com. That's where you can download the mini zine, Write Outside Responsibly. There's also a lot of other things of just how to be aware of culture sites, plant life on those lands. Also, you know, the roots naming as well, but also how, you know, how to be respectful on the land and how to educate yourself as well. So there's that on
the
kitty.
Can you hear
that? Sorry. Get it now.
That is a very, the cat's like, get
the
scenes.
So it's on the website. You can get it there. There's loads of other great little mini zines on there too from our community. Or if you have a zine that you want to share with us, share with the community.
I'm sorry.
Oh, my God.
I can hear it purring.
Oh, I'm so happy.
Can you hear her purring?
Sorry, that's great.
It's like purring in my brain.
Wow. That's what will happen when you get these zines. There's that sound.
If I close the door, she will, like, claw and cause a ruckus at the door.
Oh.
So I just have to, like, let her do what she wants.
Yeah.
Let her do what she wants.
And then she'll go. I think she'll go now. You should go
we
now.
We all love it.
Oh.
Okay, she's gone. She just had to do her patrol. She's like, I just gotta check. Make sure everything's fine. Okay, I'm leaving.
Yeah, she just came in. Yeah. Yeah.
Aww.
Should we? Is that a fun segue to ask you, Christina, about your dog?
I have a dog. His name is Sherlock. He's a husky terrier mix. He's 10 years old. Yes, and he is a strong, healthy, rambunctious little man. And yeah, he is my shadow. He is my shadow. He is there with me everywhere. He's been on all of my life adventures and has got...
Is he a trail dog?
He's not a great trail dog. Do you go cycling together? So I've learned.
Yeah. Not all dogs could be trail dogs.
Like, I've tried to introduce that quite late into his life. But we can manage it. He's getting better. I do take him out with me on the rail trail. So I have like a little cart, you know, like a pet cart that you can carry them around that attaches to your bike. Yeah. So my partner and I, we will take him with us to do that. When he was a puppy, I would put him in my backpack. And ride my bike with him, so he'd have like his little head out.
Oh, it's so cute.
And I would take him to the park. I'd take him everywhere with me. But he's gotten a little bit bigger, you know, he's grown. So now he just goes on long walks and sometimes comes out on the bike with us. So yeah, I don't have enough pictures of him in the dog cart, but I do need to get more of him on there. He's a very good traveler. He's been around to a lot of places. So he's very good. It's just getting him used to the trail is something, because he wasn't always motivated by food, if that makes sense. Like a lot of dogs are easier to a lot of dogs are easy to train when they're motivated by food. Sherlock was not motivated by food, and I think it was a husky thing, because he's quite picky about his treats. They have to be high quality.
Organic, local.
Like a fresh piece of salmon straight from the fresh waters.
Yeah.
And so he was not motivated. It had to be high quality. And like, huskies are interesting creatures. They will starve themselves if they don't. Yeah. And yes, if they don't get what they want,
like in protest.
Really?
In protest. Yes. My God. In protest. And he just, like, they can go for a really long time without eating too. He just would not be interested in treats. And I think just maybe, I would say maybe 3 years ago is when he started getting interested in food. When he started getting interested in like eating like routinely. Like before then, he would just graze on his food. Yeah, like, and he gets very good quality pet food. Like I would actually cook for him. he's not like that anymore. Oh, but Sherlock. He was a very picky young one, and now he's super motivated to listen and to follow and to eat treats.
I like that, the evolution, the change.
That's yeah, nice. it's interesting. He was I say he was very rambunctious when he was a puppy, because he was just very independent, very stay 10 feet away from me, like don't touch me. But now he's very cuddly. He's very sweet. Aww. It's like I have a different dog. I just think hormones, you know, hormones and our pets exist. And yeah, the time has changed him a lot. Yeah. Yeah. He's the best thing in the world. You guys have pets.
Oh, that's so
I'm
nice.
I'm cat-sitting right now that we just encountered.
Okay.
I get to see my mum's bird once a month when I go visit my mum, which is the smallest parrot in the world. The breed. Cute. They're called parrotlets. It's so much fun. It's such a nightmare. because parrots are just so intelligent, it comes like with them just having personalities and wanting certain things, and like because you can't communicate properly, it's just navigating that is quite fun. So it's a good challenge for my mom, I think, to have like a difficult pet.
I love watching these TikToks where like the parrots talking. Those are my favorite.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, have you seen the one that's like, what yes! are you doing? It's like a parakeet that keeps asking, what are you doing? She's shouting back like, what are you doing? How are you? What are you doing?
Yeah, many times.
I'm too old. TikTok. I'm not on TikTok.
I've seen that TikTok. It's so good.
I need to get on.
Link below.
I'll put a link below for our friends like Jenny. Yeah, that don't... Yeah. But
TikTok is a happy only.
I've downloaded TikTok and I opened it up and it's just like this barrage of video like just flying past you and I'm like, ah! Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like being pummeled. Yeah. Yeah. It's like beat up by social media.
You have to take it in doses, but like they're often like shared. I often see them like shared through like Twitter or through other people's like Instagrams stories, and yeah, I get exposed to those ones. I love animal TikTok. Like that is my happy place. When I'm like, I hate social media, but I'm gonna go to animal TikTok.
Except, yeah, I would allow this. That kind of leads into our question we usually ask our guests for 3 social media recommendations. They don't need to be cycling, because it's always just fun to like get new recommendations and consume like what other people or finding out what other people are interested in.
Okay, there's like a few. It's really hard to think about all their names.
You can do more than 3. That's okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm we'll currently obsessed with this other zinester right now. She, I want to call her, I'm trying to think of her handle. I'm really sorry. I don't have it off the top of my head.
That's good.
That's fine. We can put a link. Yeah,
I want to call her Brianna. Her name is like Brianna, but she goes by Bratty X Brie. So BrattyXBre. She's a Black and Polynesian artist and zinester. She makes tiny zines.
Cool.
And she makes them into earrings.
Oh my god.
It's so good.
Oh my god, that's good.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Just hiding she something does, on like, your earring.
She
like,
makes like a tiny zine station. Like, say if you're going, you know, like zine stores we love are like zine fairs. And she makes tiny things. Wow. Tiny zines. Oh, it's so cute. So she's amazing. I actually, another account I shared was Indigenous Women Hike, and I really love the work that they do. They do a lot of education around recreating and connecting on the land.
Cool.
And for those like who want to know more about what we were talking about, they're a good account to learn from. The other account I'm really obsessed with, and this is all like zine related stuff, Muchacha's Fanzine. They are also like, they focus more on like punk feminist, like punk intersectional feminism. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, promote a lot of like punk, punks of color, and music. And they have a zine as well that focuses on various stories from like the POC community, like in zines or in punk music or in like organizing spaces. Yeah, and those are some good initial social media accounts to follow that I am currently obsessed with.
Cool.
Yeah,
I definitely want to check out Little Zine Earrings.
Fantastic.
Yes. Check
my next.
Yes. Like that's the so best cool. the best. We need it's some, like don't we? My other happy place besides animal TikTok. That's kind of it. My initial.
So should we do?
I feel like that's, should we do our we've kind been of talking about that tough question last show. Like that's Christina's work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. I mean, true. We'll mention it. Like, we usually true. Ask all our guests. So, I take that back. Yeah. Initially, we were asking this question, how do we get more underrepresented groups into cycling? Only to the underrepresented groups. And then we caught ourselves and we're like, hang on a second. Why are we only asking this to Aisha McGowan and Jules Walker? Like, we should be asking this to everyone. And it's funny because when we asked, like, our white guests, they'd always just be like, I don't know. I'm like, let's think about that. Yeah.
They'd be quite shocked. And I think, like you mentioned before, Christina, like, get a bit defensive. I know I've done it in the past. You're like, you know.
Yeah. In the past, when I was blogging, that was about. Whenever, like, I would work with a brand, that was actually a question that I would ask them. And because it helped me as a blogger, like, engage with a brand to see if their mission and their values aligned with my own. And I always felt it was really important to ask, like, what are you doing to get more underrepresented groups into cycling? This wasn't to, like, attack or to, it wasn't, you know, a question so that you know, people, you know, would become defensive. This wasn't it wasn't an accusation at all, but, like, especially working with, like, a lot of, like, women's brands specifically, you know, we would often talk a lot about gender inequality, and gender inequality is just, you know, one form of mainstream feminism, where, you know, when we bring in intersectionality, there's so much more that we need to address. But that was a question that I would always ask a brand before I worked with them. It was important for me to align my values with them if I would work with them. It's still, even if I wanted to now, it's still an important question that I would ask. Yeah, I think the zine, you know, is one way that storytelling, let people own their narratives, let people tell their stories. And when they do, you know, make sure they're compensated as well, yeah. Make sure that they have fair access, that we're setting up our businesses, that we're setting up our institutions so that equity is at the center of it, that we are intentionally creating an environment where we are going to, you know, where we do invest in the community, where we do invest in BIPOC voices and talent and creativity, you know, where we are creating the infrastructure, where we are being inclusive of those groups. And there's so many ways that, you know, that we can address this question. We can go from accessibility in spaces to infrastructure. But all of those spaces that offer access, that create access, you know, or in business or through infrastructure, like, we all have a responsibility to create inclusive spaces, inclusive businesses. Yeah. We all have a responsibility to the land, and we all have a responsibility to each other. That's where I would go with it. We gotta pull ourselves out of this individualism, and work into our collective community, so that we are breaking down these hierarchies. And when we're able to work in non-competing ways, when we're able to focus on our community and share our, you know, and share our power with one another, we can, you know, make a lot of changes. We can break down a lot of barriers. We can break down a lot of these hierarchies that corporate spaces benefit from.
Nodding along the entire time, I'm like,
I've been nodding so much. Honestly, nodding, like, yes. Yeah, I'm like, oh, my neck really hurts. Yeah, oh,
but it's so, it's really, really just inspirational. I feel so like warm and happy having this conversation with you, Christina. Like, this is just cool. I'm like very happy.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, no, thank you guys for like sharing space.
Thank you so much, Christina.
Sharing space with me, because I know that these conversations are, you know, being had in these like small vacuums and by, you know, by the BIPOC community at large. And I know that, you know, a lot of folks in this space, like, you know, we are seeing how things are going back to normal, and I think we are discouraged by watching people go about business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of us are, you know, truly trying to make cycling inclusive. And when that work gets derailed, it gets ignored, it gets erased. I've had a lot of the work I've done be erased and reduced. Mm-hmm. And when that work gets erased, it gets, you do get very frustrated. You get burnt out from addressing this stuff constantly.
Yeah, for
sure.
That's why we talk to each other and we fill our batteries back up and rejuvenate. Once again, for the kids in the back, how can we support you and your work and Christina?
Yeah. Well, you can follow us on Instagram. You can share Amplify our work, Amplify our collaborators as well, and buy our zines. Put them in your bike shops, and put them in your, you know, your bike companies. Have them lying around in special places. You know, lunch space. You know, things like that. Also, subscribe to our zine via Patreon. So that we can keep paying our collaborators as well and collaborating on other projects too. You know, we really try to give back to our community as well. So like, you know, 10% of our zine sales a month, like go to an organization. Right now we're supporting the Trevor Project that supports young LGBTQ folks, for counseling, suicide prevention, mental health care as well. So we want to be able to support our communities where we can, even outside of biking.
Cool.
Yeah.
And the website is?
Ciclistazine.com is our website. And I think Instagram is at Ciclista.
I'm on it now.
I'm in the mainframe.
I'm in.
And I think on Instagram it's at Ciclista _ zine. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So find us. Reach out to us. If you want to work together, I'm always down for collaborating with folks. We've done some really fun collaborations with the Black Foxes and forget CC Magazine.
I love watching Aisha right now. Like, she's doing all her riding, and that's like the only thing I'm in, like, with pro cycling. I'm like, I'll watch that.
honestly, that's what a lot of us are saying.
The only
right
one
now.
I will watch.
Yeah, the only reason why we're following the sponsor is because of Aisha. Mm-hmm. We're like, otherwise,
and it's exciting. I'm just like, she's riding. Yeah.
She's so strong. She's doing so well this year.
Nice.
Like, she's so strong. Like, it's incredible watching her this year. And yeah, I've watched pro cycling in the past, but I've been really discouraged by it over the years.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's where a lot of my frustration comes from too, and why starting the zine was really important. But I think having Aisha out there and not just doing her thing with racing, but also like supporting her community.
Mm-hmm.
Like pulling her community with her is like amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. And that model should be replicated. Like more people should do what she's doing.
Absolutely. We love you, Ai.
Yeah. Go, Aisha, go.
Go, go.
Cool. I think that's a wrap.
Like, that's a wrap.
I did.
It's lunchtime.
That's a wrap. Yeah.
I have a
Thank you so much.
A funny quick aside. So when you were talking about the colonial gaze, So Ev and I have been watching this History Channel series that's like old called Ancient Aliens. And it's like...
I know this.
Do you know this one? Where like yes. The meme with that crazy guy who turns out he's Greek. So Ev like takes the piss out of him. But the entire time we're yelling at the TV because it's all old white men basically saying, well, the native people of Peru believe in this god and they said they were star people and like aliens. And I'm just like, you're like, and exactly what you were saying about how the stories of indigenous people then get co-opted and taken from them. And this... I was like, that show is all of this.
This, exactly. But this, it's not just like, it's history. It's academia. It's like how like academia gatekeeps white old men to tell these stories.
Oh my God, yeah. And they make the money off of it. And
they make the money off of it. Exactly. Exactly.
I've got one more to add on to that, that Action Bronson does a show where he gets friends on and they just get absolutely baked. They smoke like loads of weed and they watch that Ancient Alien show.
Oh, yeah.
Just like adding on to more people making money off of that show.
Yeah, we saw Mel Gibson with it, you know, like Mel Gibson did the one about the Aztecs. I forget what that one's called. That was horrible. I'm like, see, this is the problem with like having them tell our stories. Yeah. It's just like, also, you know, like history books, for example, like especially in American schools, like, you know, the way like Native people are being taught in schools where I literally like, okay, gonna rewind a little bit, but like, so I have some other British neighbors that we're friends with and they have three children. And one time, one of the parents was asking me about like some cultural stuff, like, cause I guess like the schools weren't like teaching real Native history,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't teaching like local Native history.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, her mom was asking me questions and the daughter had heard that, you know, she's like, you're Native? And I was like, yes. And she said, I thought they were all dead. I was like, who taught you? I was like, who taught you? She's like, they don't teach.
What?
She's like, the schools. They said that they once lived here. And I was just like, I said, we're still alive.
Yep.
I'm living proof of that. but yeah, it was like, how do I teach these kids with like being, I have to be appropriate with them. Age appropriate to educate them too. But it was like, all right, so we have the education system. Like we have a whole series of things specifically in the U.S. that has erased us.
Yep.
From the parks to the freaking national anthem, like everything in this country, like, you know, purposefully erases us. So it's all right, how are we going to address that gaze? How are we going to, you know, to take back what was stolen from us, what was erased? So yeah, there's God. Yeah, it drives me nuts when I hear non-natives tell our stories.
Yeah.
And profit from them.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. It's It's infuriating. Yeah. I mean, I grew up with the American school system as well, and just, you're just completely fed lies.
Lies.
The whole way up. The whole way from kindergarten all the way up. Yes, it's all lies. And then later on, you just start to realize, you're like, oh my God, like, this was just propaganda the whole time.
It's just propaganda. And honestly, if it wasn't for growing up connected to my culture and to my family, I don't think I would have known like half of the stuff I know. So like in our tribal systems, like we do have to be educated. We do have to do classes. We do have to do some language courses. When I was young, we weren't teaching our language because, you know, a lot of it had been erased. Some of it had been lost, but there was like a revitalization project that was being done, and they got a program and education done in like 2012. So like in my late 20s by then. So I didn't grow up like having the ability to hear my our language, but I did grow up like around family, around other tribal members and around like powwows and family gatherings and ceremony. So yeah, it was just being educated by family or being educated by the tribe was like so different than being in the school system as well. Yeah. Like,
yeah,
it was always a problem for my mom to like, they're teaching me these lies. They're white lies.
And they're testing you on it. And they, like, it's a requirement to get into university if you want to.
Yeah.
Regurgitate the lies. And that's how they stay in charge.
It's national conditioning. Conditioning. Yeah.
And then brings it back to why storytelling is so important. Because that's how.
Yep. It's how we own. It's how we own our narratives too, right? So this is why I actually actively discourage my friends from letting journalists tell their stories. I actively ask them to ask the journalists if you can write them, and that they pay you. I've had things in the past, like especially with the Name the Change campaign, we had a journalist who did profit off of being able to tell some of the stories from the Native folks I was working with.
We didn't even touch on that.
It's totally up to you if you want to include it in a part two.
I was going to say, I think we have to have you back.
Yeah, I'm happy to. And
I think we have
to. Yeah, I think there's like experiences of going through that. And I was just kind of like, this is why owning our narratives is so important. I saw a lot in different like bike media of how like other journalists were writing other people of color stories. And I was like, look at the way that they are telling the story. Yeah. Look at the way that they are positioning people of color in these stereotypes.
It's reinforcing the model, aren't they?
Exactly. And I think I just like, and why is it always about black pain? Why is it always about brown pain? Mm-hmm. Why can't we talk about our joy? And, you know, like joy is so important for us because it's, you know, it's how we cope with like trauma, how we cope with intergenerational trauma, systemic trauma. I think I just was like, I've had enough of seeing this nonsense. I'm going to tell all my friends, don't work with them. Like, don't let them exploit you so that they can get brownie points for allyship.
Yeah.
And not pay you.
We have retreated to the comfort of our homes to digitally record the Wheelsuckers podcast, which is now edited by Wardour Studios. Wardour have remained strong, providing professional recordings and editing in these unusual times. Let their team of engineers, producers, and composers be your guide. Visit wardourstudios.co.uk for more.
Alex and I really love what we're doing and we want to continue, but we can't do it without your help. Become a third wheel and support us today. You'll be in good company with these third wheels: Aurelia Venschlovite, Karina Fussell, Kirsty Chestnut,
Sally Bremner, Jonathan Rothwell, Annie McCarthy, Max Meyer.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Benz Bala, Luke Rocher, Jenny Raphael, Ciclista Zine, Ella Bori, Kirwan Lister, and Benjamin Irving Fields.
If you like what we do, squish that
like
button.
Rate
us on iTunes and
subscribe.
If you can't give us your money,
give us your stars.
Shh, don't keep us a secret. Slam that share button and tell all your friends about our show.